if models stabilize on one type of model like they are in LLMs, or if model innovation slows down, I think that that will create more opportunities for ASICs because, you know, in the same, like you have to think about these two, ASICs versus GPU is rigid versus flexible. And right now when there's a lot of change, flexibility is extremely important, right? It wasn't a surprise whenever LLMs popped up that GPUs like were like, perfect, boom, we know how to work on this. Versus I think that if, you know, in a different world, there could be a, like the TPUs probably had to be like a little bit changed in its core to better deal with some of the LLM issues. And I think there's actually even aspects that in the networking where they didn't foresee some of these things. So the rigidity has to be shifted. And so it's just rigid versus open. That's really what it comes down to.
Welcome to Software Snack Bites. I'm your host, Shomit Ghosh of Bolt Start Ventures, and today we are excited to have Doug O'Loughlin on the pod as the first ever second-time guest, actually.
Wow.
So, you know, maybe we'll make this an annual thing, who knows? But for those who don't know Doug, we'll first listen to episode 4 for a deep dive into the semiconductor industry and all the components. But if you had listened to him then, you know, frankly, you could have made, I think it's a little over 200%.
It's probably much over now. Yeah. Yeah. NVIDIA has gone parabolic this year. Yeah.
Basically, you could have made a lot of money in a year on NVIDIA if you had listened. And so hopefully you all will listen more carefully now. But anyway, Doug is the founder of Fabricated Knowledge. It's one of the fastest growing research publications focused on the semiconductor industry, doing really well. He's consulted as an expert by many people. And so anyway, Doug, thanks for coming on. Let's just, you know, let's dive right in. You made your NVIDIA call in March 2023. And since then, that has been bang on, correct, and incredible.
What's really funny is actually one of my first posts ever is GPT-3 and the writing on the wall in like 2020. And the conclusion was NVIDIA probably wins forever, or at least in like the foreseeable future. The return on that, like truly, I wish I just like put all my money in that, just never, you know, throwing away the lock. And but yeah, no, I've been positive NVIDIA for a long time and for many rightfully good reasons. But obviously it's not just NVIDIA's game. It's a big ecosystem. So I'm sure we want to talk about a lot more than just that today.
One thing I don't think I ever covered with you is why are GPUs and CUDA so important in this, and I'll call it the modern LLM era, for lack of a better thing, but it seems like it's actually being used in other areas as well. But just kind of this new AI hype cycle, why are GPUs and CUDA so important?
One of the reasons why is because Jensen, in his far-reaching vision, kind of went to the universities and gave away GPUs and CUDA for free in like 2010. So, you know, in the very beginning, he put it into everyone's stack, essentially gave away GPUs to any PhD researcher and really like intercepted it then. And so all this research and optimization and like true bottoms up work that was being done before it was even remotely viable as a business model was done on CUDA. And so, you know, there's extremely long shadows in software for hardware, right? Like, my favorite example, this is actually JavaScript, right? JavaScript was like written in 30 days in 2000, and no one would have ever, people hate JavaScript or hated JavaScript. Now, you know, it's the de facto language of web programming, and it's because it was there early and it improved and got a lot better. Was it the most elegant solution? Definitely not, but now it is the incumbent solution. And I think that that's where Jensen did a really good job. So CUDA was put into almost every research service or research project done in the 2010s. And so now, you know, these PhDs, they graduate and they use what they know. And so CUDA has become the de facto standard. And that's like one of the far reaching examples where Jensen really just like hit it out of the park a decade ago. So
in terms of CUDA though, specifically, like it's a bunch of libraries and accelerators and all these like components. But I guess the good thing is all of these things are packaged together specifically to work with GPU hardware. So you couldn't use CUDA to work with AMD's GPU or whatever they're calling them, but you know, their version of GPUs.
Yeah, they're essentially a GPU. And to be clear, like, I also want to like maybe talk about this a little bit is like, yeah, it's a GPU, but like the graphics processing unit aspect of it doesn't really hold up anymore. Like a consumer GPU that you can get for like $1,000 is many, many, many times better at performing, you know, graphics processing than an H100. Like you know, these are, frankly, they're much closer to just like an AI processing unit. So there's a lot of specialization that has happened. And I guess I think sometimes people think that GPUs are not specialized enough, but realistically, for the last several years, they've already been kind of going to this way. And I think the thing that's really, really, really powerful about, and I'll kind of like talk about this. Jensen talks about this a shit ton. So I'm like, you know, this is not going to be a surprise. Is that one, it's relatively general purpose, meaning that the GPU, the way it's made, and it's made from matrix multiplication, right? It's relatively general purpose enough that you can use another matrix multiplication problem. It doesn't just have to be AI. And so that's the reason why it's had so many different variants and so many different levels of success, right? Before LLMs, there are CNNs and DNNs, right? Mm-hmm. Those were obviously used on GPUs as well, because the GPU is relatively general purpose. Meaning, and there's like this whole concept called GPGPU, general purpose GPU, which is super duper confusing. But yes, GPGPU, the GPUs get used because not only are they specialized and much better for the task than CPUs, but they also have a lot of, you know, ability to change. And then last but not least, the software support. Jensen will talk about this, man. So not only is it in LLMs, things have been software optimized, right? Like let's say folding proteins for, you know, drug discovery like that. They went and optimized the software stack for that as well. And, you know, like, and LLMs is obviously like the big one that's like really exploded, but there's hundreds of different libraries that have been optimized for the software stack on GPUs. And you know, Jensen's like, you know, that's really great and all if someone wants to come out and beat us in one specific type of a library or a compiler that matches for a specific problem. But he's like, there's hundreds of problems that need acceleration. And we have hundreds of libraries that we keep up to date that is better optimized. And that's the reason why they have more software developers than hardware developers. So they're always keeping the GPUs up to date. And they're doing all of that behind, you know, behind the scenes. So
for someone to take that on, basically what you're saying is they need to, you know, kind of almost do what happened 10 years ago. And they need to go to all these research labs. They got to start embedding it. But also at the flip side is like, if you're a research lab, why would you start to use something new where you'd have to, you know, optimize it all over again, where it's just like, well, no, I want to progress my research forward. And so then this is the best place.
Yeah. Like, think about it this way. Where's your best man hour spent, right? Is your best man hour spent to hire a 5 to 10 person team to figure out a compiler to right. Then, you know, it's like, look, I just want a good LLM and I can use what's available, like an industry standard product and software stack. And yeah, it's expensive. It's way more expensive than number two. And I know in theory that I could get a better product if I made this like Chinese puzzle box just for myself. But in reality, open ecosystems win because as long as they keep improving and everyone can use them, you get to amortize that cost against everyone. And that's what NVIDIA continues to do. And actually, quite frankly, the reason why we wanted to talk about this, and this kind of like pairs up with this, is like Grok, right? I think, you know, that was like one of the topics we really want to talk about. I think that Grok is actually a really good example of this, is that Grok is a specialized one-off optimization that probably won't scale as well as you think.
Okay.
So that's like my relatively, I don't think it's that spicy, honestly, but there will always be, you know, this is going to be a huge market. So I definitely think there's a space for Grok in it, but yeah.
I don't know. It feels kind of spicy-ish. Like, you know, Grok kind of took a little bit of things by storm and everyone started talking about it and like, you know, so... let's take a step back. Why did Grok kind of, you know, why did everyone get so excited about it?
So I think it's because of I'm sure you saw the demo of like the 700 tokens per second output, right? I believe that was 70 billion llama that it was done on. And to be clear, man, that demo's been out for a while. Like, I saw that demo in November, okay?
Oh, okay.
And I was like, great, that's really cool. You have this awesome throughput, right? But I asked him, what's the size of the model and how many chips did it take to train this or to inference this? And they didn't tell me the second one. They told me the first one. And to me, that's the answer. Because I think that, I think Grok and also Cerebus to a certain extent, and Cerebus is a really good company too, they're kind of maybe, and this is like, you know, this is like a really deep technological question that, you know, people who are working on the technology are trying to overcome this bottleneck. But then people who are like, you know, also in the space are like, dude, that's kind of a dead end. There might be a dead end at SRAM scaling. And that's like their way of making, of serving the memory on chip.
SRAM, what does the S stand for? Is it storage or?
Dude, honestly, that's a really good question.
What does SRAM mean? Like what, why is it important?
It's like a type of memory that's extremely, it's like logic size essentially. Okay. What is static RAM? Okay. There we go. That's okay. So what it is, oftentimes in a CPU, let's use a CPU example here. There's a cache that is right next to the logic in your computer, essentially.
Yep.
Like think of it as a scratch pad, right? It holds these values to be computed on and then it like spits it out, and it has to be super duper fast because it's the scratch pad that's taking the information, being loaded, and then like spitting it back out. So it's like the last, like, you know, bit of data handling right at the edge. Okay. And one of the things that's been really important in making better and faster LLMs in particular is we've figured out that, you know, the logic is one thing, but the single biggest bottleneck is the memory, you know, holding all that data and passing it back and forth. And the closer you can get to the logic, the faster it is. Now, SRAM has a problem because SRAM also describes kind of like a core technology of making the chips here. And the type of memory cells has kind of stopped scaling, meaning that, you know, I think in 2015 or 2018, it's one of like the broken scaling laws as well. And pretty much we can't make it any smaller. And if we can't make it any smaller, that means we can't make it any more dense. And that means we have to spend more memory area to do this.
Yep.
But also at the same time, it's still the fastest memory available to us. But it's extremely expensive. It's essentially like buying logic, like, you know, but for memory prices. Anyways, all in, Cerebras and Grok are using SRAM to hold the models, meaning that they're using this type of memory that's the fastest possible, and it's really good. But we also know it has a dead end because it hasn't been able to scale. So that's where I get really concerned.
So on their chip, I don't know if this is the right way to categorize it, but their chips are bigger or have a bigger surface area allocated to memory because they're storing the most or the entire amount of the model on that thing, and that's making it super fast. Is that the right way?
Yeah, that's correct. And the problem is, though, is we know it's a dead end. SRAM scaling has stopped, so we can't make SRAM, like, we can't make it any smaller. So the only answer is to just make a lot more SRAM. And so let's talk about SRAM scaling here. Is like, I think they're using the 14 nanometer process at GlobalFoundries, right?
Yep.
They're alleged to be the Samsung 3 nanometer customer. And we know that SRAM scaling in this case is maybe 3 or 4 times better. So meaning that all the memory on this chip, we know will be 3 or 4 times bigger. But the problem is, I'm sure you know about LLMs. It's not 3 or 4 times bigger. We're talking orders of magnitude bigger. I mean, I did some math before I did this podcast, and it's like there's a reason why they do the model on a local, like essentially Llama 70 billion. I'm sure that still takes like 200 something chips. If they were to do it on GPT-4, like to inference that size of model, we're talking like thousands, tens of thousands. Of chips in order to inference the model, and that's being done on 8 GPUs. So like the scaling there, it just isn't available to hold all that memory. And so what GPU makers have done is they've chosen to all in on HBM. HBM stands for high bandwidth memory, and it's like a faster version of DRAM, which is like your typical memory in your computer. Now, the biggest and hottest story in semiconductors right now is how much DRAM can you get into these things? Like that is like
and that's like the Microns of the world, right? And like SK, yes, Hynix, yes, I think, and stuff like that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, SK, Samsung, and Micron. And we can even like I'll break out and talk about that for a second. SK is the by far away leader right now, and I think they have a really enviable lead that is going to persist for maybe 2 years. So that's an awesome place to be. I literally wrote up SK Hynix and why I think they're great in like one of my recent posts, and it's like, it's free too. So you
can, we'll link to it.
Yeah, it's free. Yep. So you can even read it. You know, you'd have to be a subscriber. But high level HBM, I think HBM as a percentage of the bill of materials for for a GPU is going to grow faster than the cost of the GPU. Meaning the entire plan is to shove as much HBM in there in order that we can keep the scaling alive. Like, for context of like the order of magnitude difference, the SRAM we're talking about on a Grok or a Cerebus chip is like in the megabytes, and the DRAM that's being put onto these logic chips, we're talking about the gigabytes. Like, you know, H100 is 80, H200 is 192, B100, which comes out like literally in a week, will be a lot higher than that, right? So we know that these numbers are, they're going to push that to the highest possible limit. And that's going to be like, that's going to be the way they scale this out. Because how the models are inferenced today is all that memory has to be in that HBM. And so you can figure out your overhead of an inferencing a node. It's pretty much how much HBM is in it for these GPUs divided by the model size. And that's the size, that's like the constraint of your GPU inference cluster.
Okay. So a couple things I want to pick apart there. So one, first, I guess the question is, we've always been making the chip smaller and smaller and smaller, or I guess we've been trying to pack more stuff onto the chip, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why not now just start making bigger and bigger chips, in the sense of like, okay, if that's true, like we need, you know, for the Groks of the world, right? We need the SRAM. Like, let's just blow it the hell out, make a huge, massive chip with a bunch of SRAM and still have the processing power and everything and put that in there. Like, why is that a limiting factor?
That's already happening.
Oh, okay.
So to be clear, that's already happening. But the question is, where do your dollars go the furthest, right? And so let's say, hey, we blow out this SRAM thing. We'd be talking about a chip like Cerebus is actually the perfect example of this. Cerebus did this. They actually blew out their entire chip to be the size of a wafer. And it's like as much SRAM as you can possibly put on it. And I think it takes multiple of those chips to inference one model now. Like Cerebus essentially, like if you fill it all the way up to the wafer, good to go. You can inference it. But the second it goes over, you're starting to have problems. They wanted to put it all on one wafer. And I think the design error was that it's a lot bigger than any one wafer. And we're already doing that. And like, because don't forget the GPUs here, GPUs themselves are fanning out. Like last generation was a monolithic, meaning it's the biggest die size possible stitched with UV. We don't really need to talk about that. But yeah, going forward, next generation will have more silicon area than last generation and the generation before. And HBM is also another good example of how we do that. So HBM is high bandwidth memory, but what it is, it's like the upcoming one is going to be 12 high stacks, meaning that it's like 12 pieces that we just stack on top of each other to the max amount available space. So it's a way that we can make more silicon area in a smaller footprint. And then after we do that, we put them together. So we are already like, you know, we are trying to fan out as much as possible. What you're describing is called fan out.
Okay.
We are already fanning out as much as possible.
Okay.
And yeah. And the thing is, I think that the reason why HBM is a better choice than SRAM is on a dollar basis of how much silicon area you can purchase. One is going to get a much better return. One is like, you know, one is quite literally the most expensive real estate ever. And, you know, you could buy it and whatever, you can scale out your SRAM, but we're talking like, you know, then your chips are, the cost to you will be in the tens of thousands of dollars and your gross margins will be a lot worse. Now, yeah, is that a way to compete? 100%. But NVIDIA will probably just like, okay, fine, we'll just lower our prices and your business model doesn't exist. So
one thing I would ask about that, I guess, is like, we've just talked about like how NVIDIA's chips, I mean, yes, they are getting specialized in certain areas, but they're still kind of this whole GPU concept, right? Like they're still more generalizable into different use cases. And then they have the CUDA ecosystem to help you out with these different things. But I think what Grok and Cerebrus are saying is just like, we'll screw that. Like we don't, you know, all those other stuff, that's fine. But like, we're just going to be really freaking good at LLM inference. And we're going to design this chip to be really good at LLM inference. And if you care about that, then you'll pay whatever margins we need you to pay to buy our chip. Right. And so like, I why wouldn't that work? Right. It seems like, hey, if you need inference, just do this.
So I think that works to a size. I think the problem, and you can go read this in Cerebus's marketing material. I'm not, you know, I didn't see like they have it like, and it shows, you can see where it breaks down is if the model is too big for the chip, they don't really have a solution that fans out past their single chip. Mm. And that problem is like doubly so with Grok, because Grok is already a smaller chip put in together. So the thing is, all of a sudden, now you're paying money for wires. Okay. You're paying money to connect it all together. And surprise, surprise, that isn't cheap either. Okay. And so there are design things pretty much like it was described to me as like SRAM scaling versus HBM scaling. HBM scaling is like the less elegant, but like the best one you'll like essentially take. You have to let me get like the exact quote here, but like they're both bad bets, but HBM is the less bad bet.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. That's kind of the thought process of this. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. By the way, you know, one thing I want to go to, and this is kind of NVIDIA related, but also I think related to the Grok and Cerebras story, is you mentioned those wires, right? The wires that you need to connect those things up. It seems like all of a sudden we're going from, you know, this Ethernet world to now like this, you know, NVIDIA acquired Mellanox, and everyone's saying like, oh, InfiniBand is like the best thing since sliced bread, and this is like a secret weapon and another moat that like NVIDIA is stacking. Is that really true? Like, are we moving away? Like, Ethernet's everywhere, right? Like, are we moving away from that?
No, I don't think we're moving away from that. I think actually, and like, you should look at the product design, the product announcements from NVIDIA. We are moving to Ethernet, actually.
Oh.
Bigger picture step back. InfiniBand was like the most popular networking fabric for GPU clusters in like a research, HPC kind of capacity for decades. Okay. So, they were the incumbent solution, and they're electrical based. I think there's some optics in it as well. And it's been scaling, whatever. But I do think that it seems pretty clear that Ethernet will make the crossover after 1.6T. And don't be like surprised. NVIDIA is like already, they already have a product for it. So like, they've already thought that one ahead. Yeah. Like, and like, to be clear, that got announced in like 21. So
oh,
like,
oh my God,
they have a whole, it's like it's Spectrum X. That's the name of the switch. So, but yes, Ethernet and Infinite, like it is, the networking aspect is one of their biggest competitive advantages, because not only do they have the GPU, they have the networking. And for example, the fastest level networking you can use today is the NVLink. And so pretty much what they have is they support the open ecosystem, and then they have a proprietary superset that is faster than what the open ecosystem offers, but it's backward compatible. So it's like, look, you're already using our GPUs. You want to use our, you know, you want to use them on the 11th, you know, turn it to 11. Well, we can sell you some cables for that, right? Like, and so that's where like they do some lock in, and like, and the difference is it's huge, because it's like I think the best available is like 800G maybe, but like they were touting like 900G like 2 years ago. We're going to see what they come out with NVLink wise, at GTC. And there's like, I think Dylan Patel of SemiAnalysis, I think he wrote about this. So like, hey, this is a potential like huge thing, is there's like this race for SerDes, which is, we're not going to talk about that. Just think about like the speed of a single lane.
Yep.
And one of the things that maybe they can do is if they pull off 212G SerDes before everyone else does and ships it into their products as a proprietary thing, they'll beat the entire open ecosystem and they'll be ahead of it for like 2 years. And they'll be like, well, that's really great. If you want to be running your Ferrari on the fastest speed possible, like you could, you know, give us some more money. So I think that's probable, actually. Like they're going to have the fastest networking.
So I have some more like specific questions I want to ask you, but I just have to ask you this, like, you know, we'll get to some more Galaxy Brain questions, but like, is NVIDIA, like, can anyone, does AMD have a chance? Does anybody have a freaking chance? Because given the stuff that you're saying, they were already thinking about this like 2 years ahead, right? Like,
yeah,
they're so far, it seems like, ahead of everybody. Like,
it's like almost depressing, because it's like, it's not very fun to write about like the empire beating the shit out of everyone every single day. I think the best bet is still Google. Google's still the best bet. Oh. I know people are hating on it right now. I think the stock is, people are creating a narrative mostly because of the stock performance, which is like a whole second other thing, right? Narrative follows price. But Google still has the single best full solution stack compared to everyone else. And I think the TPU is a good bet. The networking, they actually have an amazing networking system, mostly backed by their OCS, their optical switch. How does it stand for? I can't even remember these acronyms anymore.
Yeah, well, we can look it up. Yeah.
Well, essentially what it is like they have a mechanical switch so that they have this like forever roadmap that can never be like disrupted. Really awesome thing that they did there. But at a high level, Google is the only company that probably has the chops, because they have the full stack. And so you got to think about this, that there's really two big boats in this. It's NVIDIA with the open-ish, like, you know, their proprietary ecosystem that anyone can use. And then NVIDIA, then Google with like the full stack, you know, soup to nuts, every aspect is their own. And because of that, yes, is there aspects that NVIDIA has better in? Yes. Is there aspects that Google's better in? Also, yes. But the thing is, they get to control the whole thing and create a full stack margin. Mm. And so they're the ones who have the best shot, in my opinion. And like TPU 6, great product. They have, you know, they've been doing this for a few generations, which is, I think, the biggest competitive issue, because everyone is like, and let's talk about AMD here. So AMD is the MI300, which right now is the best GPU you can buy for inference and training.
For a week long.
You can't buy the B100 probably until Q3, Q4. But yes, okay. For 1 week. For 1 week. This, we know the specs of this is the best for 1 week, and then we'll say three quarters of like actual availability. Okay. So it's the best you could in theory buy right now. But the problem is, NVIDIA already said they're going to an annual cadence of shipping, which is like, fuck, like that's so bad, man. I just don't think people appreciate how hard that is to ship a new chip every single year. If you have the lead and you can keep shipping a chip every single year, you will not lose it. This is how Intel beat the crap out of everyone for about a decade until about 2017. Mm-hmm. That's when they stopped doing the TikTok cycle. And pretty much NVIDIA has decided to do the TikTok cycle. And that is the fastest pace that's possible to ship a semiconductor. And I think that it's going to be a little bit of an eye-opener of how hard it is to make a semiconductor, because like AMD is probably going to go to the annual cadence to keep up. But even then, they will be like barely able to keep up. And you know, the other big potential competitor in this space is hyperscalers. I don't think they'll be able to ship an annual cadence. And then imagine being a startup, buddy, like, you're screwed. And so like All of this is just like this like terrifying thing where it's like, dude, we're living in Jensen's world, man. You know, that's not like, you know, the stock I do think is like really overheated at this exact moment.
Another example
I've been thinking a lot about is Core. You know, I'm sure you've heard about CoreWeave, right?
Yeah.
The GPU only clouds. I personally think that the reason why the GPU only clouds exist is because Jensen wanted to essentially, like, so they gave them the reference design, like, here's how to make the biggest possible GPU cluster you can. Here you go. As long as you buy all NVIDIA stuff, you're good to go. We'll support you. And then they just raised a ton of capital, did that, then sold it as a service. But if you think about it, that is actually a way to lower your customers' concentration against you, because there is this new vector of hyperscalers that are coming online, right? So GPU clouds are this new vector.
Hey,
why don't I finance a new competitor and give them a shit ton of GPUs? So now the three people who can pester me has a fourth option that I can just feed in case they're being a dick. Like, it's like you know what I'm saying?
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, yes, they're you know, the largest funder on the cap sheet, but like, I do think the reason why there is a reference design that anyone can do if they just take a ton of money is slightly to dilute the fact that the hyperscalers up until this point all had their own specialized hardware stack. So it's like you and I couldn't go buy hundreds of CPUs and make a hyperscale stack. That was just not available to us. The networking, all that stuff was proprietary. NVIDIA kind of opened it up in order to make it more to make their barrier lower. So
some things I want to ask off that. So one, first off, I mean, okay, NVIDIA is taking over the world, you know, all this stuff, but they still have a bottleneck. That is TSMC.
Yes.
And there's nobody else that can do what TSMC does at this point in time. Who knows? And maybe for a very long time.
Intel. Yeah. I'm not joking. Intel has actually had kind of a shot, but anyways, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. All right. But anyway, let's just say, so not many. And meanwhile, like you said, the hyperscalers are building their own chips. Guess where that's going to TSMC too, right? Like, isn't that like kind of, isn't the weakness in the armor kind of just like the actual fab here?
Yes and no, right? Because even for all this stuff, all the gripe about NVIDIA and like, oh, we can't get these GPUs. One, they've definitely increased the supply availability a lot more than anyone thought they could about, you know, 6 months ago. And number two, NVIDIA is still not a top five, is maybe a top five customer now. I think they're probably 10% revenue now. But like Apple is still a much bigger customer. And Apple, let's just say you go buy a wafer, right? You go buy a wafer for like $50,000. I don't know the ASP. You can find it online. Yeah. And you go turn it around and you sell it in iPhones. It's like, you know, $300,000, okay? But the problem is like TSMC isn't even really getting it because they sell wafers. So they're getting it in volume. You go buy a wafer for $50,000 and like NVIDIA is going and selling it for $2 million. Like the markup on it is insane. So it's like in a way, I don't know how, like, and that's where NVIDIA, the systems company, has really managed to find a lot of ways to like keep moats around their profit pools so people can't enter. But like, yes, in terms of the very long term, there are ways to compete this away. AMD is going to become a real second source eventually. And one of the ways they're always going to be able to do this is by lowering their price. And we have a perfect case study for this. Like, if you've been following consumer GPUs for like the last 20 years, like I was a consumer GPU for a long time as a high schooler. Dude, AMD is always a year late with a cheaper product that gets parity to the previous product.
Right, on the gaming chips. Yeah.
And what do you think is going to happen in the future?
Same thing.
AMD is going to be a year late with performance parity and a cheaper price. We're already there. That's literally what the MI300 was. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll see you at MI400. Like, this is the path. And so, you know, that will be a competitive edge that will keep some kind of, like, it won't make, you know, they can't have this share forever. I don't think that that's reasonable, but yeah, you're probably right that I think the entire semiconductor ecosystem is relatively not undervalued, but underappreciated, and now starting to have its like day in the sun.
Yeah,
because TSMC can't be recreated. You know, Sam Altman's trying to raise whatever trillion. Who knows what the meme is? But like, you know, he's gonna write the check, and then he's gonna turn around and be like, TSMC, build me a fab.
Right, exactly.
He's gonna be like, go to the EDA companies. He's like, I'm gonna buy a lot of licenses. You know, it's the current ecosystem is one of the most interesting ecosystems ever, because every major player who has been in semiconductors has been in semiconductors since like the 1990s. NVIDIA is actually a newcomer on the block, and they came around in 1997. So yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But before we get into some of the future trends I want to talk with you about, I just have one question back on Grok, where specifically they did a 14 nanometer chip that is way, way behind everyone else. And I guess like, but you know, they still ship this thing that has this SRAM component and does well in inference and all this sort of stuff. So I guess my question to you is like, why couldn't we just see more people just being like, okay, screw it. TSMC is locked up. You know, Intel's locked up with these customers, right? But GlobalFoundries has like a little bit more bandwidth, and you know, let's make these specialized 14 nanometer chip. Like, what is the difference between making a 14 nanometer chip and a 3 nanometer chip in terms of if you can deliver this performance if you build it optimally for a certain use case?
Okay, that's a good question. And I think I want to actually push back on a little bit, because the fabs aren't 100% utilized, right? You can go talk to Intel and they'll be like, you'll be our customer tomorrow. We'll be so happy to have you. TSMC even is only at 90% utilization. So the utilization cycle isn't quite there. The problem is there's certain super high, like bottlenecks. CoWoS is one of the examples where it's super bottleneck, but like, you know, the industry will figure that one out. But yeah, I don't think you're completely wrong in terms of like specialization at a higher nanometer in order to like create an effective solution. And in a lot of ways, what you're describing is like a lot of the trends that have already existed. This is like, I would consider this heterogeneous computing, right?
Yeah.
You're using specialization to get more bang for your buck with a dead Moore's law. But I just think the thing that it comes down to is as long as there's continued progress. Now, like, let's say one day at like, you know, 7 angstrom, because that's what it's going to be called. They're going to start calling them angstroms now. They just hit a wall. Okay, so like 18A is 18 angstrom, and then TSMC is going to call it angstrom as well. So let's just say they just like hit a wall. Then whoever has the most specialized solution will win. But I think until then, as long as you're able to show improvements with a general open ecosystem and like a lot of support, you'll probably beat out the specialized solutions. And the thing in Grok's specific case that I think I have like real concerns around, there's this guy, Rational Analysis. He's like, I think that's his Substack name. You can't even like, he talks about that. He does an amazing breakdown on VLIW, which is very large instruction width. Essentially, it's like, it's the method of the compiler that Grok and TPUs, for example, do a little bit of this as well. TPUs has like a lot of other things built into it. But pretty much by making this compiler, what that forces is that you're going to have to spend a lot of time and man hours to do like assembly code to like, it's like assembly code level like compiler work. And that is a problem.
Yeah, that's hard.
That is a solution that does not scale. Like that is, you know, so, yeah. So my understanding is it took 90 days for them to get that improvement out of Grok, or something like that, or maybe even longer. And I think that the implication there is those 90 days were probably the entire compiler team working their working their asses off to make Llama 70 billion work.
Now you got to make it work with Mistral, whatever. And
Mistral and GPT-4 and those are small models, man. Like in this outcome, you are like, they are going to have to eventually tie themselves to one model. Not the worst thing if it's, you know, an open source model on the smaller side, and you have to choose small, and then you can offer maybe a full solution. And that's a whole business model that frankly could work, right? Like we're talking about like maybe having a managed service for, queries that aren't that sexy, but that, you know, run extremely fast and maybe are at the edge or something like that.
Yep.
That's a real business model. But the place where everything that's super duper exciting and is like, hey, actually, we're seeing some singularity stuff. Like, I'm sure you've been reading about the Claude stuff that came out.
Yeah.
That's a big ass model, man. It's a big ass model. And I promise you that is not going to be like, we would be tens of thousands of Grok chips. And that's.
Yeah. Well, you even said the SD RAM just, it can't hold it.
It can't. And so like, the other thing too, and like, there's also another really good write up that I wasn't even aware of this. And this one, I think you might find really interesting is, there's actually a lot of variability between data centers. There's like huge we are really early days in terms of this. Like the same provider can offer you multiple clusters, and for whatever reason, one of the clusters breaks every single day and the other is perfectly fine. And there's no one knows why. Okay. Like, and that's like, okay, one, that's like kind of scary because, hey, if they optimize the hell out of this, it's like, wow, a lot of compute supply just showed up, and then, you know, demand supply curve crosses, and then like, hey, we're overbuilt. That's definitely possible. And I don't want to count that out, but I also think it shows the entire immaturity of the whole thing. We are, you know, I don't know if LLMs are going to be the singularity and like everything changes or whatever. I don't know the business model. I do think there's like, you know, things are running a wee bit hot, but things can run hotter, right? Like, I don't know. But I do think there are a lot of things that show that we're so early in this process of even figuring things out. The fact that there's that much variability at an infrastructure level from a cluster like basis, you're like, what the hell? Like, this is, I don't know, this, that never even occurred to me that was possible, to be honest with you. So,
well, okay. So I want to now move into more of like the finance, side of things, because we went through some of the low level stuff, but now let's talk through. So like you said, semi-cap, all the EDA stuff, everything is all ripping to all-time highs.
Yes.
Rightfully so, right? Everything's going. But I guess like for some of these cases, especially something like the ASMLs of the world and the KLAX and all whatever, all those companies, right? Like it's still literally equipment that needs to be made, delivered, money received, right? Like,
yep.
And so like,
yeah, the joke is that's the second last job that will be done before the singularity. Like we have, like, that's where the physical, you know, all these chips and all this stuff, like all the information that's processed literally like in digital atoms and stuff, there is a place where it exists in the real world before it becomes a chip. And that's semi-cap. And
so,
yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Like, are we too hot? Like, are we too hot in semi-cap in the sense of like, we still need those things to be delivered. Yes. Orders are going to go up. Yes. The duration of those orders probably is 10 years, 20 years out. Right. But like, you still need to deliver.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that one's too early, to be honest with you. I do think like, and I want to like, literally I need to have a little bit of a heat check. Okay. I wrote a piece about momentum in semiconductors and how we are like, yesterday was the single best day, like 15 day period versus software ever in semi.
Oh, that was so cool. I love that chart. Yeah.
Yeah. So like there's a little bit of a heat check. Okay. Like, please, you know, heat check. Okay. I'm just going to give that out. But yes, is like, dude, making a semiconductor is so hard. Okay. And that's what actually got me like, you know, Shomik, you've known me before I was a semiconductor guy,
yep,
right?
Yep.
I am a stock guy. I like semiconductors quite a bit. But the thing that really got me into this is like, hey, man, I was like doing this research, like following these software companies. And I'm like, this is really great. This like HR software company, you know, I do think numbers are going to go higher, stuff like this. But I'm like, dude, they're placing atoms. They're placing atoms in semi-cap right now. Like, they're sitting there and it's like, yeah, we have a 99.9% effective process, and that's not good enough.
That's not good enough.
Actually. No, I mean, I'm being serious. You have to have multiple nines in order for any chip to work, because it takes 1500 steps to make a chip, dude. 1500 steps, and each of them have to be perfect, because you know it's to the steps is how much error that you create. And so, you know, 80 people are like, oh man, the yield at Samsung's really shitty. It's like 60% yield. That implies most of the steps are 99.9%
good. Yeah, right, because it's compounding. Yeah.
The compounding is so big. So, like, you know, these are some really amazing, like, everything that we've ever done in physical sciences is being done at the highest level in semiconductors. Like, Asian, like, there's a tweet thread I've like have in my drafts. I'm gonna actually send it out one day, but like Asianometry does the best example of this. You definitely gotta watch the YouTube channel, but like, they're talking about how like ultra pure water, there's like, it's so pure we can't measure its purity anymore. We know it needs to be more pure than our best measurement tools are able to give it, and so we just do statistical methods and be like, yeah, it's probably good enough. Like, we're beyond limit. Like, we can't see anything. Okay, man. Like, every single time you see a cutout of a chip or whatever, that is actually data given back to us, and then we recreate it using like math. Okay, like, there's no light. Light is too small. Okay, or light isn't. Sorry, light is too big for us to make any images, dude. Like, all this shit is beyond anyone's comprehension. And like, there's so many levels of this. Like, you know, they're the clean rooms that TSMC is doing in it. It's like a class one clean room. That means one part per billion particles. Okay. And the entire air of the entire, like, and these are giant like warehouses, right? They flip the entire air out every minute and a half.
Oh my God. Yeah. There's no COVID, like, there at least.
Yeah, definitely. The joke was it's the cleanest room in the world during COVID. Like, you're like, yeah, the fabs are still open. But like, dude, I'm just telling you, everything you've ever heard of in physics that is going at the most insane level, I promise you they're doing it in semiconductors. And I think that that's the thing that's like really cool about this is, like, you know, there are real tangible moats here, because it's like, how the fuck did we do this anyways? Like, you know, like everything is like an actual miracle of science. And that's what keeps these businesses like having such good returns on capital. You're like, well, how do you know that someone doesn't enter their moat? And it's like, dude, someone wrote about it in a research paper 15 years ago, and it went to production this year. And everyone's like, I don't know how this works anyways, but it seems to work. Like, there's a whole like copy exact. Like, when something works, you literally just don't touch it ever again. You're like, do exactly what you did. You don't need to know why anymore, because like, yeah, we're talking about electrons, like quantum like having quantum error issues because they're like, oh, it's too close. It's fuzzy. It's hard to even measure it. Like, every aspect of making a chip is essentially indistinguishable from magic. That's like one of my favorite lectures, actually. Indistinguishable from magic. It's like, if science is so sufficiently advanced, it's indistinguishable from magic. And that's semiconductors for you. Just making the process, making a semiconductor, and then, you know, the business model of it, whole other thing. But like, dude, these businesses are super advantaged, and it's not like, you know, it's not like we're going to learn how to make a different, you know, in a different way. Like, this is the playbook. These are the companies, these are the players. Like, they're extremely valuable and probably will continue to be so.
Yeah. Great explanation. And every single time you talk to me about those clean rooms, like, just the mind explodes. But I want to move into the custom ASIC story, right? In fact, actually, NVIDIA came out saying that they might even start designing it themselves.
Yep.
And then Broadcom stock has had the second coming and is off into the races, right? Like,
yep.
Like, is Broadcom really that important to this story? And then how do you rate NVIDIA's chances of kind of getting into that space?
So before we continue, Broadcom's ASIC is the Google TPU.
Oh.
So yeah. Okay. So who makes the Google TPU? It's not just Google. It is also Broadcom. And they expect to make about $10 billion of revenue from it this year. So they're the big number two in terms of this story. And also, the other part of the business that is just like completely and utterly untouchable is the switch business. Man, everyone has been trying to crack that thing for decades. And here we are. Hock Tan reigns supreme. The man is an absolute beast and does business in a very like 90s way. Like, he's brutal. But yeah, I would say Broadcom is probably the second best bet in terms of actual, like, we'll say actual AI revenue, right? Because Whereas AMD is almost like a Me Too derivative of how much share can they take from NVIDIA.
Right.
Broadcom is a close relationship with Google. And there's been some conversation. I saw there's like an information article about like them potentially getting competed away. But in a very long period of time, I would guess things get closer to ASICs. Like the GPU every single year model will work until it doesn't work for some unforeseen reason.
Yep.
And like, for example, if models stabilize on one type of model like they are in LLMs, or if model innovation slows down, I think that that will create more opportunities for ASICs. Because, you know, in the same, like, you have to think about these two, ASICs versus GPU is rigid versus flexible. And right now, when there's a lot of change, flexibility is extremely important, right? It wasn't a surprise whenever LLMs popped up that GPUs like were like, perfect, boom, we know how to work on this. Versus I think that if, you know, in a different world, there could be a, like the TPUs probably had to be like a little bit changed in its core to better deal with some of the LLM issues. And I think there's actually even aspects that in the networking where they didn't foresee some of these things. So the rigidity has to be shifted. And so it's just rigid versus open. That's really what it comes down to. But over a very long period of time, I think, you know, remember, Jensen is literally playing like 40 chess or something. Yeah. I would say that's like a hedge. Okay. Like, you know, he's finding a way to hedge against, you know, it's like a cheap option for him probably. But I do think that ASICs will become a much more important part of the story. And I think actually the entire semiconductor ecosystem is going to end up becoming this like weird, it's a weird space, okay? Because like Marvell is a good example of it. Marvell is, they do ASICs as well as pluggable transceivers is what they're really known for. But Marvell's entire business model is like, hey, we're going to essentially just suck up to the hyperscalers. And we're going to do our absolute freaking best to do as many co-design partnerships as possible. And we're not really going to sell silicon anymore with like, you know, in the past, you know, you make a really good chip, you sell it to the market and the market buys it from you. It's like, no, we're going to partner with the people who we know are going to buy it and we're going to build it with them. And so the entire fabless and IP ecosystem is kind of retooling to become this like custom as a service solution. And I would say that everyone is doing that. Like, and I think even the packaging, like AMD is doing that. For example, they're talking right now and they're like, hey, we have FPGA, CPUs, GPUs, whatever solution you want, we can build it for you out of the box. And yeah, maybe our gross margins are worse, but maybe our operating margins are better. And you know, you're the only ones who are going to buy it anyway. So that there has been an ecosystem shift to better serving the hyperscalers. And I think that that will probably continue in the foreseeable predictable future. The only way it doesn't is if like OpenAI or someone is so successful that they can actually create so much money in dollars that, you know, they're not, you know, the big three aren't the ones paying the actual bills, right? Because right now the big three are essentially investing in companies and paying their bills for them, right? But until then, I think it's follow the money and the money is there.
Yeah.
So everyone is just like retooling to suck up to them. So
is there any trend right now in semiconductors that you think will still surprise to the upside? And I don't mean actually in the longer term, because I think in the longer term, like I think you just made the case for why the whole thing is going to surprise to the upside.
It's extremely valuable. We have no idea.
Yeah.
How, yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of like, I don't know, I'm just saying like, you know, I'm making it up, but like 9 months, right? Like, is there anything that you're like, oh man, this is still underhyped?
Man, I feel like that's hard because sometimes I really struggle to know what's hyped versus not hyped, like versus me. I'm like, oh, this is an obvious one. I think two things come to mind. I talked about HBM before, but I really think that, look, man, I'm actually a memory hater. I'm like the biggest memory hater you can talk about. The businesses historically have sucked a lot.
You've written quite a few pieces actually about how memory has like gone through this cyclical thing and like,
And like pretty much their entire business model is how much money can they fork over to Lam Research? Like seriously, especially NAND in particular. And I think that HBM has a chance of being, and like, you know, hate to say it, this time is a little different. HBM, I think, is the thing that gets me really excited because, you know, we know that the model complexity and the model size is scaling a lot. And we know that the biggest bandwidth is how much can we put it in HBM. So far, they already said they're sold out for the year. So I'm sure they're going to find a way to make more for that. Okay. Like to sell more, but I think that right now HBM is clearly the place where we're feeling the biggest lack. And that will continue probably much bigger than what we think, right? Because we're talking about like, hey, you know, and HBM is scaling in a way that like, you know, it's 10x, 20x more, but it's not scaling in a way that's 100x like LLMs. They're going to need a lot more HBM. And I think that there's even industry dynamics that make it really interesting, because by everyone in memory is spending every available dollar they have, and they literally just stopped burning cash, like every available dollar they have into HBM, because it makes so much more money for them. And so by doing that, DRAM is actually getting a lot better because they're not going to spend any money on it. So supply growth, like, so there's like this, like, you know, meta level thesis that, you know, the rest of memory is actually going to be fixed because of how much spending HBM is going to take as a percentage of the share. I think that that will surprise and probably is an interesting trend. The other one that I really think is a big deal from like more of the process. Well, maybe I'll choose two more. Okay. From the process side, hybrid bonding is going to be a big deal. Hybrid bonding is just pretty much the best way we can do advanced packaging. It's like perfectly bonding two surfaces together, and it's going to be big in HBM, for example, is like, and so like Bessie's example of that stock, but that, I think that one is like a long-term process-oriented development. It's not going to, you know, it will go multiples bigger from here, but like over 5-10 years or something like that. And then, you know, I want to spend a hot second talking about Intel, because
I think this is your call. Like, you know, you got to make a call every year, right? So maybe this is your call.
Well, no. So, okay. One, to be clear, Intel was my call last year. Okay. My call last year. I actually said, hey, it's like, we're good. The Intel stock went from like 30 to 50 or something like that. And the reason why is because Intel's process is fixed. And I think that that's a big deal. But not only the reason that it's fixed, because like Intel is going to struggle to find customers and become a more customer facing business. But, you know, I think the interesting inflection there that I think maybe the semiconductor nerds are all over and no one else cares about is called something called backside power delivery, which is this extremely clever way of making a semiconductor. So up until now, we've all been making it on the front side, okay? There's the critical transistor layers here, and then we build up all these layers past it. And so there's two types of layers for metal in particular. It's signal layers and power layers. But the problem is, if you make the wire smaller and smaller, all of a sudden we hit something called IR droop, where resistance, like if it's so small, your resistance in a wire will actually be really high. So all of a sudden your chips are not being able to be powered really well. So someone came up with this really clever solution. Why don't we split the signal and the wire? So the signal is like, you know, moving all the information, and the power is like obviously powering it. We put the power on the backside. Okay. So by doing that, you know, there's more layers, and that's good for semicap. But what we're doing is we're actually able to use less EV, and then we're able to use less power for more performance. And that's something that I think is a really big fundamental shift in the way that we're making semiconductors, akin to EUV's insertion in 2018 that TSMC did to overtake Intel. Intel is doing this quicker than TSMC is in order to take it back. And so that's like, I don't know. I don't think there's like a really great stock story for this anymore, because like Intel kind of already fixed the process. And I've written a lot about Intel in 18A in the backside. But like, I think that that's something that like probably shocks the hell out of everyone, is like, guys, Intel's process, like, Intel's been such a loser for so long, and like their actual design of selling the CPUs, not the greatest business, but the Intel process, I think it's back. And I think that people who know, and everyone else is like, Intel's this loser. And I think that there's going to be at least a perception shift. And I think it's good for America, man. We need leading edge semiconductors to be done here. Yep. So, you know, it really remains to be seen if they can make a viable business out of it, be better customer facing. But in terms of like Intel, the process, I think it's back.
Quick question for you on that backside thing. Like, by putting it, you know, by putting it differently or on the other side, right? Like, aren't you, like, you said the performance is increasing, but wouldn't it increase the latency or something because they're further apart?
Signal.
Oh, okay.
Because the latency is being all done on this side, and then the power is being done on this side. And it's really a really clever thing for like one specific problem. Because the IR, like, we're talking like one of the problems for yield was that essentially the metal, like any shifting of metal, like the slightest, would mean that the contact wouldn't hit and your semiconductor wouldn't be powered. And so that's actually one of the problems with yield, that like TSMC is actually having some problems with 3 nanometer yields. And one of the reasons why is because the power power has become this giant problem, especially at the micro scale. And so backside power is this really clever way, like it still gets power to the other side, and the latency, it actually lowers the signal layers. So there's even better signal and there's even better power. It's just by special, you know, it was doing two in one, and then we just put one for one so we can make each do their best job. Now, the problem is that's more metal layers and that's more cost. But at the same time, it's a solution to scale semiconductors further. So everyone's like, hell yeah, I'm in.
Well, I'm making the call this year, at least my call that I'm co-opting with Doug, even though he may not say it as well, is Google in the mega cap. Obviously, there's going to be stuff that could perform better stuff.
Oh, but dude. So I'm buying Google for my mom's PA in the mega cap. Okay.
Yeah.
I will say that. Yeah. Okay. It's like 16, 15 times forward earnings. They are actually number two in AI. I know everyone has like problems, but like, I'm the first to say that Google's product shipping ability is very lacking. But in terms of like, you know, they literally invented the transformer. Yeah. I don't think that means they're going to be number one because they just haven't had the cadence and ability to ship. But like, I don't think that means they're not in the game. They're going to be in the game. And I think that it just doesn't make sense where the stock is trading. So
it is my largest position right now too. And so anyway, we'll come that up. But one of the things, Doug, that people may not know is the old school mule before you know all the semi fame. You used to look into a lot of different trends, and you were like,
yeah,
I still remember when you were like telling me about perfumes one time, which I was like, I don't even know where you're coming from. You nailed cosmetics. I remember you were like bullish on like Elf and some other stuff. And then like those stocks, I mean, if anything, if you look at Elf stock chart, it's like NVIDIA.
It's kind of like wild. A mini NVIDIA. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess like, What trends or companies or whatever outside of semiconductors, outside of even if tech, if you want, like what sort of weird areas are you like curious about or interested in right now?
Okay, so none of this is financial advice to begin with.
Yep.
So probably one of the ones that have been historically the most successful, and I still kind of like a little bit from here, is AppLovin, ad tech company. I have like it's up like 300% last year. It is my largest position. You could go watch a podcast, yet another value blog. I did AppLovin, and that is my most timely call I think I've ever done. Amazing, awesome, great stuff. Still like that company quite a bit. I just think they have a really interesting share shift from Unity. But I think the place that I'm most interested in is maybe applying some of my semiconductor brains to, this is going to be really weird, crop protection chemicals. Okay. So, okay. So, and to be clear, there's like some governance brain here. I'm definitely really into the governance thing. Non-GAAP has pilled me for life. Not going to talk about the specific signal, but I'll tell you essentially the output. I really like companies like FMC or Corteva. So what happened was, just like every other semiconductor cycle, they ordered way too much, that they had way too much on hand. And so now there was this giant inventory destocking, and the inventory destocking probably ends this quarter or the next. And it's not like some places where it's like, do we actually need this consumer stuff? No, dude, crop protection chemicals is like the fertilizers and the, you know, like to prevent herbicides and pesticides and stuff like that. We need this stuff. And these stocks are super cyclical. FMC is a company I've been involved with in the past, and there is a really weird short report out there that's like probably partially correct, but at the highest level, man, they have not been, you know, revenue's down like 50% or something from last year because it's just like the inventory is so stuffed. But I think what happens is the inventory clears at some point.
Yep.
They literally are talking about like, hey, our inventory projections are actually starting to be on track. You know, all of a sudden we might be talking about a 2021 business sizing. And, it trades for like, I think it, on those numbers, I think it trades for like 9 times earnings for like a full cycle, something like that. 15 times earnings for FMC. And we're talking about a company that's like 50% higher. So, and I like that because in a lot of ways it's, I think the semiconductor cyclical brain is something that I've picked up through doing semiconductors, right? Like understanding cycles. And I think the semiconductor cyclical brain has actually died because this most recent cycle has been really weird, really insane. And it's clear that what's happened is we're going from cyclical to secular in terms of the multiples. And so, you know, buying cuts and stuff like that just doesn't work like it used to. But you can go next door, use all those skills that you honed from, you know, cutting your teeth in the cycle and look at a company that you understand we will fundamentally need because everyone has to eat and say, wow, I think that inventory cycle is gonna clear itself. And all of a sudden, a lot of pessimism will turn to optimism on this business. So,
you know, kind of in the crop vein, actually, one that you may want to look at, Mario Sabelli is a big fan of this one, but it's called Becle, which is in Mexico. Basically, they make... I think it's
BE. Oh, okay. Are you talking about the
tequila?
Yeah, they make the tequila. Yeah. Okay. So no, I don't know.
Because the agave prices.
Oh.
Well it's interesting because it's actually more of the inputs. The agave prices are going down. There's a big like issue with it, right? That finally got resolved. And if you look at that, like that took time. Mario has been talking about for like the past 2 years, right? So it took some time, but then it just kind of first landed this quarter and you just saw the stock like shoot up. And then I think there's probably some more ahead of it just as it. So I think what you're observing is like those same cyclical patterns like exist in so many different areas. And I think like,
Also 2020 was the most like everything became a cyclical. Like seriously, everyone overordered too much inventory. And then at some point in 2022, they're like, shit, because, you know, the supply chain got better. All those double ordering we did for like shoes or something like that came due. And now we have to discount all this stuff. Yeah. And so like everyone's business models went from like this to this. And so like in a weird way, like being able to pick up some of the companies that are, you know, are not going to go away after the inventory bust is in a lot of ways like old school semi. So that's one of the companies that I've really enjoyed, you know, kind of learning a little bit about right now. So
yeah, well, it's always fun to talk to you, Doug. I think we'll make this a little bit of an annual thing because I imagine also this space is going to be moving quite quickly for the next few years.
I gotta say it's starting to feel like, I mean, one, I do feel one of the reasons why I think we're at a little bit of a pico top is because just like the podcasts and requests for interviews and stuff, it's just really hot right now. Yeah. But like, this is a really hard space and it's going to be really important for a long time. And I think it's really important for people to be all over it. And, you know, I feel like I called my shot a few years ago on this happening. It's happening. And I'm just like, what the hell? This is like way bigger than I ever thought it would be. Awesome. Yeah, so yeah,
I still remember when you're like, yeah, I'm like going, I'm taking this red pill, like, and I was kind of like, all right, cool, like, you know, you do your thing, and then you know, turned out to be quite right. But you know, Doug, what should anything coming up that people should do? I mean, obviously, I think you'll be writing about the B100, right?
Yes.
The B100 coming out.
Yeah. The B100, obviously going to be covering that because it's going to, like, you know, this is like, it's the Super Bowl, okay? This is like the most important event. There's also, like, at least I have like an idea of baking. I'm not going to like really leak it at all. There's just no reason to, but I need one thing confirmed. Okay. And I'm going to confirm it the week after at OFC. So, I should hopefully, if everything goes well, have an interesting idea, after OFC, and OFC coverage itself is going to be a big deal because, like, you know, we're talking about all the wires, right? Like the week before is NVIDIA. NVIDIA is going to be like the Super Bowl, but then the week after is like, hey, how do we wire these things together? And that's the entire ecosystem where there's just more like variety and ways to play. And so that's going to be really fun.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of cool technology. So I'll definitely have something interesting for that.
We'll tell like everyone, as you know, you should be subscribing already. You know, we need Doug to continue this level of research for all of us to just continue to learn what's going on. So please support him. The best way to do that is by subscribing and paying for his research. And I guarantee it will make you smarter. So Doug, thanks so much for doing this. Always love talking to you, man. And we'll look back on this and see if you know, your mom and my personal account are doing much better this time next year. So
yeah, I hope so. That'll be really nice. So anyways, thanks for having me, man. It's really nice to see you again. Take care, Shomi.
All right, see ya.